Sunstone Foundation presents Patriarchs and Politics, The Struggle for Voting Rights in Apache County, 1960 through 1976. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
To introduce Eduardo Pagan, who is a native of Arizona, Mesa, Arizona. He's received a Bachelor of Arts in History from Arizona State University and Master's in History at the University of Arizona. And he's currently working on a PhD at Princeton University in New Jersey. And he's come a long way to speak to us, so we're pleased to have him here. His wife is Karen Hall Pagan, and he has two daughters, Jordan Catherine and Laura Alicia. And his response will be given by Dr. Charles Peterson, who grew up in near this area that we will be hearing about today, so he can give us an interesting perspective on these events. He has been the director of Utah Historical Society, the professor of history at the University of Utah, Western Historical Quarterly editor, and he's the author of the book Take Up Your Mission, and Director of Studies of Northern Arizona, where he's treated subjects like race relations and irrigation. So we'll proceed in that way.
Thank you. Before I get started with my paper, let me explain the map that I've drawn up here for some of you in the back. This, of course, is the state of Arizona.
Phoenix is over here. St. John's, which is the capital of Apache County, is down in the south. This is Apache County itself. It's a long, narrow strip. And the Navajo Reservation intersects with Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona. And so the part that I'm looking at in particular is the Navajo Nation in Apache County and the problems that were concerned there. Students of the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s have largely focused upon the black experience in the South. Yet other minority groups in America joined in that quest for equality. The Navajos in northern Arizona, for example, struggled with the Mormon-dominated government in Apache County to finally emerge from under decades of political bigotry and exclusion. Because Navajos' fight for greater political access occurred within the context of their larger effort to protect their cultural and legal identity from the encroachment of the dominant culture, the study of that episode in Arizona history holds a particular significance for Mormons who have long held a special missionary interest in the American Indians. Underlying the fight for political power between the Mormons and the Navajos was an even greater conflict of culture and ideology forged from decades of mistrust and misunderstanding. Before I continue with this paper, several caveats are in order. One of the difficulties in writing about Mormon history is that when one speaks of the collective, one must also recognize that individual actions do not always reflect the will of the whole. Or, as the Osmonds put it, one bad apple don't spoil the whole bunch. At the same time, however, one must recognize that the environment, history, and culture of the whole has a significant influence upon the individual. With this understanding in mind, for the following reasons, I have chosen to use the collective identifier, the Mormons, when referring to those within the county who oppose Navajo political involvement. First, most of the white population in Apache County, who fought to maintain the status quo, were descendants of Mormon pioneers, who themselves were a unique and sometimes oppressed minority within Arizona's white population. Second, the descendants of the Mormon settlers in Apache County continue to exercise hegemony in the county government. Third, as Mormons, the county leaders possessed a set of rules and ideology which governed quite specifically their conduct and strategy in their fight to retain the political control of the county. And fourth, I found little evidence of dissent from the activities of the political leaders, and I believe that the views of the county officials accurately reflected the will of their constituency. One final observation. When referring to the Mormons in this essay, my primary interest is in the behavior of an American subculture within the realm of Arizona politics. This examination is not meant to reflect upon the religious institution of the church at large. Almost half a century before Congress granted American Indians the right to vote in 1924, Mormon settlers from Utah significantly influenced the political activity in Apache County. As part of the larger colonizing effort of Brigham Young,
Wolford Woodruff authorized a missionary serving in northern Arizona to purchase 1,200 acres near the county seat of St. John's for the establishment of Mormon domination in the region. Although they faced rigorous and often violent opposition from earlier settlers of the area, the Mormon colonizers faithfully sought public office once they established themselves as a commercial power. To this day, the descendants of prominent settlers enjoy quasi-dynasties in county government, sufficiently influential so that news of the Mormon Church often appears on the front page of the St. John's newspaper, the White Mountain Independent News. Although the industrious pioneers succeeded in making the desert blossom, relations with their Lamanite brethren were not as fruitful. Teeming with roving bands of Indians, the St. John's area fulfilled Brigham Young's requirement that the Mormon colonizers find a land of so little value that others would not want it. The sanguinary confrontations between the Indians and the Mormons significantly slowed the colonization process. As one historian recorded, the Indians succeeded in sending the less astute scurrying back to the more comfortable surroundings of the homes and kinsmen they had left in Utah. Consequently, the constant state of siege produced a lasting impression upon the pioneers, which in turn greatly influenced the relationship of the county officials with the Navajos. Part of the white control of Apache County rested upon the exclusion of the Navajos from the political process. Rather than persuading the Navajos to vote for white candidates, the county oligarchy traditionally chose to exclude the potential voting bloc through neglect. Because so few voter registrars were assigned to the reservation, for example, no more than 10% of the Indian population appeared on the county registration lists, even though the Indians made up almost 75% of the county's population. Each voting precinct on the reservation, assigned by the county recorder in St. John's, also served 3,500 Navajos, compared to one precinct for every 1,000 whites in the southern county. And three of the seven voting precincts on the reservation covered areas larger than Rhode Island. Apache County registrars also strictly enforced the literacy requirements, the only ones in Arizona to do so, which particularly prohibited the Navajos from registering to vote. Arizona statutes required that every voter demonstrate literacy by reading from three cards containing selections from the Constitution in the English language in a manner showing that he is neither prompted nor recited from memory. Given that the Navajo tribe had a median educational level of only 5 years of schooling, and that the average Indian student performed 2 to 3 years below those of white children, the average Navajo therefore had a literacy effectiveness closer to that of a second or third grade education. Thus, many of the Navajos in Apache County failed to qualify to vote almost before they picked up the cards to read to the county registrars. Nor could Navajos vote in special elections, such as bond issues, school board elections, and special assessments, because they failed to meet the property requirement of Arizona voters. Since the federal government held Arizona reservation land in trust for the Indians, rather than permitting each tribe to own their own land, few American Indians therefore owned real property. The Arizona Advisory Council to the Civil Rights Commission dryly observed in a 1961 report, "These property qualifications tend to disenfranchise many in the minority groups." In addition to suffering limited access to the ballot, the Navajos also suffered from the lack of equal representation on the County Board of Supervisors. The boundaries of the three supervisorial districts, drawn at the time the territorial legislature created the county, gave two seats on the Board of Supervisors to the white population of roughly 5,000 in the southern county, and one seat to the Navajo population of roughly 25,000 in the north. As the aforementioned factors effectively combined to block Navajos from the ballot, the supervisor from the northern Navajo district came exclusively from the small group of whites living close to or on the reservation itself. The conditions which excluded the Navajos from voting resembled those in the South, which disenfranchised blacks. Yet the residents in southern Apache County understandably resented any suggestion of racist behavior or comparisons made with the South. The Mormons had a long history of working with the Indians in a variety of missionary and social programs, each designed to assist the American Indians in blossoming as the rose. Unlike the South, which created elaborate voting restrictions and gerrymandering techniques in a direct response to black suffrage, county officials argued that they simply inherited voting statutes already established by the territorial legislature. This argument proves important in understanding how the political leaders of the county perceived themselves and how they reconciled the disparity between their religious faith
and their secular practice. The Mormons of Apache County did not create the voting statutes, which some admitted were unfair, yet their religion required that they faithfully observe the laws of the land, and they complied with zeal. Herein also lies the dichotomy in the relationship between Mormons and Navajos in northern Arizona. Although Mormonism possesses a strong theological affinity for the American Indian, Mormon county officials played an integral part in suppressing Navajo participation in county government. Since the beginning of Mormonism, American Indians have received special attention from the Latter-day Saints. After the publication of the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith authorized missionaries to travel to the nearby tribes in hope of teaching the Indians their true identity as descendants of Israel. "It is not our duty to kill the Indian," Brigham Young also taught. "It is our duty to save their lives and the lives of their children." On another occasion, Brigham Young preached the necessity of treating the Indians with kindness and to refrain from harboring that revengeful, vindictive feeling that many indulge in. Living by these words of the prophet, however, proved to be a difficult task in northern Arizona, particularly when the Navajos were not always the willing recipients of Mormon charity. At a time when Navajos feared for the loss of traditional culture, for example, many on the reservation saw the well-intentioned Indian placement program as a systematic attempt to strip their children of their heritage. Passages in the Book of Mormon which imply that traditional Indian cultures and religions are themselves a degenerate form of the white Nephite culture and religion did not help matters either. Many Mormons, on the other hand, were frustrated with the Navajo reluctance to assimilate and refused to share political power with the people who did not share their same perspective. Thus, American Indians in Apache County suffered the same impoverished conditions as other minorities in the country, particularly in the area of political representation. Navajo tribal leaders early realized the political potential of the reservation, and evidence suggests that the tribal leadership quietly pursued its own three-tiered strategy to attain voting equality, independent of federal attempts. As early as 1962, the tribal newspaper Navajo Times reported efforts by the tribe to work within the system by patiently petitioning the county for more registrars and voting precincts, and courted politicians sympathetic to their plight. Under the direction of the tribal leadership, the reservation newspaper also ran a series of editorials and articles before each election designed to educate subscribers and encourage participation in the political process. The third tier of the Navajo strategy sought to improve tribal illiteracy through lobbying the federal government for better educational facilities and programs. While the voting conditions on the reservation remained stagnant, the Navajo tribe continued its own internal political activity. The Navajos in Apache County already possessed a cohesive political organization. 96 community chapters frequently met to discuss and vote on local issues and concerns, much like the New England town meetings. These chapters also sent representatives to the tribal government seat in Window Rock, Arizona, the capital of the Navajo Nation. Because the Navajos preferred their own course of action, however, they largely disregarded state agencies and national organizations, which may have assisted in furthering their goals. The Arizona Civil Rights Commission reported, for example, that only one complaint was ever filed against the county registrar. The Navajos also looked upon a representative from the Congress of Racial Equality, invited by members of the neighboring Hopi tribe, as more of an intruder than a helper. And although the Navajo Times observed the activities of national Indian organizations with interest, the Navajo leadership remained reluctant to join. The impoverished conditions of ethnic minorities throughout the nation, as well as the growing civil unrest in the South, compelled the Congress to rectify voting inequities. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 further streamlined earlier attempts to enforce the 15th Amendment by permanently abolishing all poll taxes and suspending literacy exams for 5 years in areas where over 50% of the voting age population failed to register or vote in the 1964 presidential elections. The act further required these jurisdictions to submit all future changes in their electoral laws and procedures for preclearance by the United States Attorney General's office. The Voting Rights Act initiated the long-awaited emancipation from political bigotry and exclusion for the Navajos. Yet the prize of political participation lay at the end of a decade fraught with legal, political, and racial conflicts. After the United States Attorney General targeted Apache County for federal surveillance, county officials responded by suing the government. Blaming Navajo apathy and illiteracy for the low voter participation, the suit questioned the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act and asked for the reinstatement of the literacy test under a loophole in the legislation. County officials rejoiced when a federal panel of judges ruled for the reinstatement of the literacy exams because the Navajos themselves could not prove that county registrars acted with discrimination. Enthusiastically hailing the federal ruling as a vindication against charges of racist behavior, county officials seemingly conciliated the Navajos. Yet little actually occurred for the next 5 years beyond a few token attempts to improve the voting conditions on the reservation. Why would county officials give the Navajos the power to vote them out of office? Interestingly, the Navajo Times virtually ignored the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the subsequent efforts of community leaders to halt its application in Apache County. Determining precisely why the tribal paper showed no greater interest in the outcome of the controversy surrounding the Voting Rights Act requires further research. It may reveal skepticism over the outcome of the Navajo's fate in a white court and indicate the existence of hardcore apathy due to decades of disenfranchisement and disillusionment. The nature of the Indians' historical relationship with the Bureau of Indian Affairs may have also determined the extent of coverage in the tribal newspaper. The Navajo leaders may have purposefully avoided raising the expectations of the tribe for fear of endangering the economic support of the federal government if the Navajo populace pushed too hard or too far for change. Finally, the editor of the Navajo Times was himself a graduate of the Indian Placement Program and of Brigham Young University, and may have played a role in downplaying the controversy in an effort to forestall further tension between the whites and the Navajos. 2 years after the 1970 amendments to the Voting Rights Act, which permanently eliminated the literacy test in every state, the Navajo leadership decided that the time was right to test the political waters of Apache County. At the urging of tribal officials Tom Shirley, a Navajo from Ganado, which is on the Navajo reservation, entered the race for a seat on the County Board of Supervisors. The outcome of the 1972 election subsequently shattered the 93-year tradition of white control. Shirley captured 67% of the vote and became the first Navajo in Apache County elected to the Board of Supervisors. The victory celebration ended abruptly, however, as whites once again moved to block Navajo enfranchisement. Thomas Minyard, the defeated candidate, sued Tom Shirley for illegally running for office. Since federal treaties exempted reservation Navajos from paying various county taxes, Minyard argued in the lawsuit that seating Tom Shirley on the Board of Supervisors would amount to taxation without representation and would therefore violate the Constitution. He also argued that since federal treaties exempted reservation Navajos from civil or criminal prosecution in state or county courts, Shirley could, in theory, engage in malfeasance in office with immunity. Minyard therefore asked that the court declare Shirley ineligible for office and him the winner of the election. D.L. Greer, the former county attorney who was now serving as a Superior Court judge, issued a temporary restraining order prohibiting the county clerk from certifying Shirley's victory until the matter could be settled in court. 11 months after Tom Shirley won the election, the Arizona Supreme Court finally cleared the way for the first Navajo to serve on the County Board of Supervisors. Shirley's pledge to fairly represent all within the county, however, failed to assuage the county oligarchy. Within days following the court's denial of a rehearing and a stay of execution, the county oligarchy launched a two-prong offensive to ensure its control of the county. Mitchell Platt of St. John's appealed Minyard's suit to the United States Supreme Court. County manager C.L. Haas then announced the formation of a committee called the Committee Opposed to Taxation Without Representation, formed specifically to secede the southern white portion of the county from the northern Navajo half. The Committee Opposed to Taxation Without Representation focused its efforts on lobbying the Arizona legislature for a new county in the case that Platt's efforts failed in the Supreme Court. In a bold counter move, a group of Navajos countered the secession efforts of the committee in 1973 by filing the first lawsuit for the protection of Indian voting rights. By suing for the reapportionment of the county supervisorial districts, Good Luck versus Apache County struck at the foundation of white control. The redistricting of the three supervisorial districts into near equal proportion would give the Navajos all three seats on the Board of Supervisors. By this time, the federal government stepped in to tip the scales of justice in favor of the Navajos' cause. In January 1974, the Justice Department sided with the Navajos by suing the state of Arizona for the failure to oversee the redistricting of Apache County and neutralized lobbying efforts of the committee by threatening federal action if the Arizona legislature approved any division of Apache County along racial lines. The district court ruled in favor of the Justice Department and ordered the county to comply. While Platt filed an appeal with another appeal with the United States Supreme Court, he persuaded the County Board of Supervisors to adopt a redistricting plan which altered the existing supervisorial districts only slightly. The following month, the United States Supreme Court sounded the death knell for the white resistance. The court upheld the constitutionality of Indian citizenship in Goodluck versus Apache County and approved the federal redistricting order. Mitchell Platt made one last desperate lunge to salvage the political status quo in Apache County. Flying to Washington, D.C., Platt was unsuccessful in his attempt to appeal directly to President Gerald Ford and returned home to await the takeover of Apache County. Thus, in November of 1976, Louise Deschini and Raymond Greymountain, both reservation Navajos, won two of the three seats on the Board of Supervisors. For the first time in Apache County's history, the Navajos gained a foothold in county government. Perhaps the most salient feature of the period under review, in retrospect, is that throughout the decade-long struggle for voting rights, the Navajos conspicuously eschewed utilizing either nonviolent or violent protests. Unlike the South, Apache County never reeled from an explosion of frustration during its long struggle over civil rights, as occurred in Selma, Birmingham, or Watts. The Navajos never organized boycotts, marches, or rallies. Although verbal threats were exchanged and public debates became heated, none of the forms of social violence associated with the Southern experience occurred, such as lynching, arson, bombing, attacks upon property, or looting. The lack of certain environmental and sociological factors in Apache County, which existed in the South, offers an insight into this anomaly. The geographical separation of whites and Navajos had much to do with the lack of civil unrest. Although Navajos faced the same prejudice, discrimination, powerlessness, inadequate housing, and unemployment which have been attributed to black violence, contact between the Navajos and the whites were relatively minimal, and few symbols of white American authority or property existed on the reservation at which to strike. The lack of white control over Navajo affairs also differed significantly from the Southern experience. Unlike blacks, for example, Navajos enjoyed immunity from prosecution outside the reservation because federal treaties prohibited county and state authorities from exercising jurisdiction over the reservation. Thus, Navajos enjoyed their own courts of law and their own police, one often cited factor in race riots elsewhere. The cultural background of the Navajos and Mormons must also be considered in understanding the nature of the fight for control of Apache County. An editorial which appeared in the Navajo Times offers an insight into the Navajo mentality during this period. Comparing the similarities and discrimination which American Indians shared with the black community, the editorial reflected upon the words of Robert Burnett of the National Congress of American Indians. Quoting Burnett, "But unlike the Negroes battling to overcome the same sort of discrimination, Indians will not engage in protest demonstrations. This kind of belligerence does not square with our feeling of patriotism. We want to give no aid to communist propaganda about dissension." Instead of public protest, concluded the editorial, the Navajos will go to the federal courts and to the conscience of the American public for relief. The history and cultural homogeneity of the white resistance may have also determined their course of action as well. The early Mormon settlers themselves faced violent opposition to their participation in county politics, and the resistance to Navajo participation was led by the descendants of the Mormon pioneers who prided in their patriotism and their respect for authority. Thus, rather than resorting to terrorism, whites fought to maintain control of the county within the confines of the courtroom. This, of course, should not suggest that Baptists, Methodists, or Presbyterians in the South adhered any less to the law or to patriotism. The theme of God, home, and country was frequently used in justifying the cause of segregation in the South. Yet the pro-Indian bias of Mormon doctrine, the strong emphasis on conformity, and the religious adherence to law and order clearly influenced the course of action taken by the Mormon leaders of the resistance. While obedience to the law and the love of constitutional ideals may have prevented Mormons from engaging in open conflict, it also served as the focus of their contention with the Navajos. Earl Platt reflected the prevailing view of the whites when he openly questioned the constitutionality of the Citizenship Act of 1924, which granted citizenships to the Indians. "If Indians could run their own government," he also observed, "they would not need the Bureau of Indian Affairs." Mitchell Platt also argued before the Supreme Court that if reservation Indians were to enjoy the full rights of citizenship in the county, they would have to behave as other citizens. That is, surrender their privileges as a protected people, pay taxes, allow reservation land to be taxed, and submit to county authorities. We need to educate the public to what is right, Platt told one reporter. What is fundamentally right in a democracy should be followed through, regardless of public opinion. In an effort to translate what they believe to be right into political power, the Committee Opposed to Taxation Without Representation shared similar goals and tactics with Southern political organizations. The Citizens Council, for example, organized in response to black political activism, worked to halt desegregation and to slow down the growth of a tyrannical federal government. Likewise, the committee organized in response to Navajo political activism, worked to halt political desegregation and to prevent federal interference in Apache County. Like the Citizens Council of the South, the leadership of the committee organized from the established business, political, and social leaders of the white community, the same group of people that made up the courthouse cliques that ran the South. Perhaps it is not surprising, therefore, that local church leaders in Apache County played a prominent role in the effort to maintain the political status quo. There's no evidence to suggest that Mormon church leaders used their position in an overt manner to gain support for their political agenda. And it may be only coincidental that the leaders of the white resistance were also leaders in the local church. Yet surely their social standing in the community, coupled with the weight of their church leadership position, undoubtedly had an impact upon the Mormon communities within Apache County. The study of that episode in Arizona history holds a particular significance for Mormons, I believe, because underlying the fight for control of the county was an even greater conflict of culture and ideology between the Mormons and the Navajos. Given the theological affinity that Mormonism has for the American Indian, Mormon leaders in the county could have provided an enlightened conduit for the Navajos' growing political power. Yet the cultural and religious assimilation that Mormons expected in return was too great a cost for the Navajos. The growing political awareness of the Navajo Nation was inextricably linked to the sweeping tide of cultural nationalism that influenced ethnic minorities throughout the country. Thus, frightened by misunderstanding and fueled by frustration, the political leaders of the county refused to relinquish control to a people they considered to be unworthy of such a responsibility. If the Navajos refused to learn American social values and accept American political standards, how could they be expected to maintain the order and stability in the county? We're unwilling to be the guinea pigs in letting them try to run a county government, said a former county attorney. We could be bankrupt in the process. In the bicentennial year of the United States, and a little more than a decade since the enactment of the Voting Rights Act, the Navajos in Apache County were allowed to step through the portal of political enfranchisement for the first time in the county's history. The Navajo struggle for voting rights in Apache County contributed to the larger efforts of the American Indians and all minorities to grasp for and hold on to the promise of civil liberty. The victory of Good Luck versus Apache County belonged, therefore, not only to the Navajos, nor solely to the American Indians throughout the nation, but to the American legislative and judicial system as well. Without the aid of the Congress and the courts, already sensitized by the civil rights movement in the South, it is conceivable that the strategy of the Navajo leadership would have achieved little. This saga is far from having a happy ending, however. The long-sought-after prize of participation in county government failed to live up to the expectations of the tribal leaders. Although Navajos control the Board of Supervisors, whites still dominate the elected and appointed offices in the county government. The Navajo supervisors also disagreed on numerous issues and failed to vote in accordance with the wishes of the tribal leaders. For many Mormons, sharing political power with the Navajos continues to be a source of embitterment. I used to think of them as my Lamanite brethren, one county official told me, but now they're just damned Indians. And even as we speak, the Department of Justice is preparing another lawsuit against Apache County officials for continued failure to observe Navajo voting rights.
There are many interesting aspects of this fine paper that I wish I could touch on. I have a set of written comments, which in view of the time left me, I will turn to in a minute. I'd like to make a few comments off the cuff if they can be tolerated. Mr. Pagan, how many Navajos are there now? Can you...
At this present moment?
Yes, 150,000 to 160,000, perhaps?
I believe it's even higher.
As early as the 1930s, Kerry McWilliams talked about the reconquest of the American West by Mexico as the tide of Mexican labor swept north and began to influence cities and localities throughout the Southwest, California particularly, where McWilliams was holding forth, but also you'd have found evidences of the insurgency of Hispanic peoples in Texas, and the continuing movement of Mexicans into the United States may very well be fulfilling a kind of prophecy that Kerry McWilliams made in 1937 or 38, I believe, in one of his noteworthy books. And if one contemplates the fact that in 1868, about 8,000 Navajos came back from their long walk to the east border of New Mexico and moved back into the Navajo Reservation, and then look at the demographics as well as the political and economic impact of a people who have surged from 8,000 between 1868 and 1989 to 160,000 or perhaps more, one sees a very vital and dynamic process taking place, and perhaps there is a reconquest of the American West in the process of development as far as the Navajos are concerned. And I think there would be few places where the awareness of this would be more acute than in Apache County. Apache County, I might say here that I have a good friend in Arizona down at Tucson named Don Bufkin, who draws superb maps, and I think maybe you must have taken lessons from Don Bufkin as I see this fine map. But Window Rock would be located about here, very close to the New Mexico-Arizona border. Immediately to the north is Fort Defiance. A few miles to the south is Fort Wingate. A few miles here is Gallup. Off over here is the town of Ganado. Maybe I placed that a little too far west in locating it, but maybe even more important, in this area in here is the Crystal Black Creek area of Navajo country, where from the very first they have prospered most emphatically in terms of handling sheep, and a class of Navajos, many of them who are mixed bloods, but they're known as Ricos because of the fact that they are very well fixed indeed. Have inhabited this area. I suppose the chief name in that group would be Chi Dodge, who was for many years the Navajo tribal chairman, but I know Chi Dodge as the banker who lent John Lorenzo Hubble, a mixed blood Connecticut Yankee New Mexican Hispano, who was located at Ganado. He lent him money to run his campaign for the Senate in 1913. It was unsuccessful, I might add, but all the rest of his life and all the lives of his sons and daughters as Navajo traders out there, they were indebted to Chi Dodge and his heirs. We rarely think of Indians as being in a situation where they have financial clout sufficient that they're the brokers for senatorial candidates and people who are looking for opportunity in this way. And Hubble was a major figure himself, a man of significance. But you have a Navajo reservation here in the three states, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico, and a large number of people are coming. They're struggling, they're impoverished, but I have spent a little time been impressed with the character of the people, their astuteness, and the fact that they're coming along as a power factor. The only one of these people you mentioned that I know personally is an old-timer named Dewey Farr, who's dead now, but I can imagine the heartburn and gastritis that Dewey Farr occasioned as the Navajos began to play a role in county politics. He was a county commissioner himself for many decades, and an avid advocate of Mormon history as far as the movement into Arizona and that country is concerned. Maybe 1876 to 1885, a 9-year period, saw as many Mormons move into the Little Colorado as northern Arizona and eastern western New Mexico as Navajos came back from the long walk. If you look at what's happened with the population in the Four Corners area, there can be no question that the Navajos are much more successful people in that climb than the Mormons are, and that it is a situation of Mormon minorities. And you better remember it, Hardy. A Mormon minority, a people who have culturally not been whatever the broad meaning of culture in this context, not as successful in developing this 160,000 base in that locality. And it's in that context that this paper struck me as being of tremendous interest and profoundly significant. One passing remark before I read my comments here. One of my great favorite passages in all Mormon writings is a passage from Parley Pratt or one of the other missionaries, the first three that went down to the borders of the Lamanites there in western Missouri. But they got down there and they learned of a tribe far to the west who live in houses and are known as the Navishus. I think this is the first mention in Mormon history, 1831. Navajos, but they called them the Navishus. And that struck me as being interesting. Mr. Pagan takes a new kind of look at political relationships in what might be called a reservation county. His approach to voting rights strikes me as at least unconventional to both Indian and Mormon studies, and perhaps even revolutionary. Yet many of the attitudes and assumptions he brings to bear are anything but novel. Although it is less than outright, his analysis tends to place the question it raises in something of the same context as Black Power, Red Power, La Raza issues have appeared in over the years. There are hints of oppressive relationships conspiratorially held. Fault for non-involvement in the political process is attributed to exclusion rather than to pre-existing social gulfs. For example, voter registration over the history of the county is portrayed as a process conducted to the specific end of keeping Navajos out rather than an in-group activity of whites callous in their egocentrism but little worried by Navajos, as the Mormons were, rather than a reflection of an accepted, if indeed not an honored traditional situation. Non-registration of Navajos is shown as being consciously subversive to American political ideals and fundamentally discriminatory, as indeed it is. The fact that I'm here today struggling with this issue is itself evidence that study of Mormon-related group relationships in this context do not abound. There ought to be other people who know more about this to make these comments than myself. But the people from Sunstone contacted me. They came close to telling me I was the only chance they had, that I had to be here. For generations, what might be called the conquest or Indian Wars mentality has dominated the American and the Mormon outlook. Nowhere has that been more true than in Arizona, where until recently the State Historical Society was known as the Arizona Pioneers Historical Society, which in the values that dominated its social structure, collecting habits, and publications was an old Indian fighters fraternity. Certainly Apache County whites, whether they were Albuquerque traders, Texas stockmen, New Mexican Hispanos, or Mormon hierarchs, or the Mormon hierarchs who kept the great register of voters, were at no pains to extend either power or the values of democracy to Navajos. As an examination of the county's ponderous and dusty great register of voters books quickly tells, they barely kept the books open to such as came to the St. John's Courthouse specifically to get their names recorded, much less reached out to expand the electoral body by bringing in new groups who neither comprehended nor had time for the values or opportunities of democracy. In their own way, more recent books, including scholarly efforts to describe Four Corners culture, have perpetuated the dilemmas of conquest in subtle ways. For example, I've forgotten Adams' first name on Shonto, but it's a study of Indian trading at the trading post of Shonto, and Vogt and Albert's People of Rimrock, which respectively studied group relationships of Navajos and traders in neighboring Navajo County and in the Rama Zuni locality, just across the New Mexico border from Apache County, described group political dynamics in neutral terms that imply, if they do not state outright, that failure to participate politically is due to informal internal relationships among Navajos and Zunis rather than the product of exclusion, discrimination, or subversion. In Voting Rights, Pagan shifts the context in what strikes me as an original piece of thinking. While some of his definitions raise problems for me, his apparent use of the word Mormon to cover all Apache County non-Indians, for example, and certainly there is nothing novel in viewing exclusion as subversive, his analysis opens a way of thinking about Mormon-Indian relations that promises much. The real kernel of his story is the conflict that arose as the Navajo electorate of the county chose county supervisors, the equivalent of county commissioners in Utah, of their own race in the 1970s, and the underlying cultural and social values that complicated the county's political processes. Necessarily, he speaks in generalizations in a short paper like this, but Pagan's recognition on page 12 that Mormon leaders failed to provide an enlightened conduit that the Navajo's growing political power could move through is as astute as it is straightforward and direct. Among other things, it points up fundamental problems of attitude and conduct for an Anglo-American religious society that is not only firmly rooted in villages along the Little Colorado, but has aspirations to become a universal movement. As the spiritual and social obligations of what might be called church worldwideism supplant millennial expectations of another worldly agenda superimposed by Christ's speedy advent, Latter-day Saint society needs urgently to come to grips with the lofty prospects of its best self. But Mormon altruism and idealism have ever been the victims of Mormon pragmatism and materialism. Certainly it was so in Apache County from the first. Mormons surged up the valley of the Little Colorado in the late 1870s, their progress justified and energized by the worthy objective of meeting the country's Indians and doing them good. But before much good could be done, a beachhead had to be established. Diverted by pragmatism and tinctured with paternalism, idealism nevertheless persisted, as evident in the comment of the county official, probably a third or fourth generation Mormon, who told Mr. Pagan, "I used to think of them as my Lamanite brethren, but now they're just damned Indians." Whether county officials or historians, Mormons find it difficult to think about Indians in terms of power other than within the familiar traditions. Our studies have consequently been limited, and our responses and policies fearful and defensive, if indeed not hostile. But in Apache County, where the realities of county politics notwithstanding, it can be argued that the Navajo culture has demonstrated much more vitality than the Mormon culture. Mormon thinkers have an opportunity to contemplate the need to apply different modes to their analysis of racially related politics. Similarly, an almost desperate need exists to ask different questions other than the older mix of conquest, altruism, and neutral description allows us to ask. In offering voting rights in Apache County, Mr. Pagan has taken bold steps that Mormon thinkers could well afford to pursue. Thank you very much, and thank you.
I'd like to open this session up for questions. If you could please come up to the mic so it can get onto the tape to offer your question. Thank you.
I was interested in Chaz's comment about your categorizing all the Euro-Americans in the county as Mormons. What percentage of the population is Mormon and what non-Mormon of the Euro-Americans in Apache County? Can you give us that information?
I don't know. That was difficult to determine. I don't have access to church records. But what I could determine was that at least the leaders of the fight to keep Navajos from participating in politics were, by and large, a great majority, I'd say 90%, were members of the church. Not only members of the church, but bishops and stake presidents as well. But among the white population itself in the southern Apache County, I don't know. I would guess, would you have any idea?
St. John's would be 90%, and Round Valley would probably be 50%.
Okay.
Yes. I think in terms of the drunks who come out of dances, it's probably more like 60%.
I'm an attorney from Albuquerque, New Mexico, so we have some geographic area there. First of all, I'd like to thank you, first of all, for your efforts last year in the Ev Meekum and then this one. Too often the church thinks that they're Utah, and sometimes Sunstone kind of thinks that, so it's nice to have people like that do some scholarly research on areas outside of Utah. A couple of comments. First of all, as in terms you mentioned that the Indians are peaceful, I think that the St. John's experience maybe is somewhat of an anathema, that the people in that area were peaceful. And the New Mexico side, it's been far from that. We've had a lot of demonstrations. We've had the Indian radicals who have been involved in the state. We haven't had a lot of deaths or things like that, but we have had police called and we've had arrests and there have been some real militants. So I think maybe that is an anathema in that little area there, and I don't know why. It would be interesting to know. Second thing, I made some notes here and I can't read what I wrote. Second thing, from a legal point of view, I can see the frustration of the Mormons. We have the same, and when you say Mormons, I mean the Anglo people there. We have the same frustrations in New Mexico. Being on a reservation, they are a country unto themselves. They can come to St. John's and buy a car, buy something else, take it back to the reservation. They don't pay for it, and we can't touch them. They will not allow us on, and so in essence, we're absolutely and totally powerless to enforce any civil law on the reservation. So there is this built-in frustration and bias, and I suspect some racism because of that situation. Secondly, I don't know how they've gotten away with it so long. On the New Mexico side, the Indians have been voting for years, and in fact, in the county commissions in both of the New Mexico counties that border the county there, there is Indian participation and has been for at least since the 60s. And so it is an interesting, again, phenomenon that the one county was able to get away with that. Last comment I had, I thought it was interesting just from a church point of view here, and I'd like you to respond if you know. The St. John's stake only has one Indian unit, and that's really only half Indian and half Anglo. There are a lot of ranchers up there in Chambers. Just to the west in the next county where the Indians do vote, there's both Holbrook and Winslow. Both of those stakes have more non-Anglo units than they have Anglo units, so there's a real cultural cross with the leaders having to deal with Indians all the time. But it's an anathema here again, because again in the New Mexico side we have the two stakes, the Farmington stake and the Gallup stake, where there are a lot of Indian units, so maybe there's more sensitivity on the part of the church leaders to Indians as, quote, Lamanite brothers. And for some reason, just, I don't know if it's geographically or if it was done on purpose that way, when this state, not what it came into being, but as the Indians have grown and as the church has grown, they've never ever incorporated into the state, but in fact have their own Indian district up just to the north. So just some observations from someone just across the border that kind of deals with this a little bit too. But thanks again for continuing this. Thank you.
My question is this kind of racial bigotry a ubiquitous feature of Mormon culture? If so, why and what can be done about it? A friend of mine recently moved to, some time ago moved to Alabama. She's teaching at a local community college. A member of the ward came up to her and said, but honey, how can you stand to work with all those black boys there? And I just moved into a new to Kalamazoo, Michigan. We're in a largely black neighborhood, and a member of the ward has said, "Now, in a few months, I'm going to ask you about how you like living in that area, but not right now," implying, of course, that there would be some kind of animosity between us and the neighbors. But do you see, as I said, to repeat my question, do you see this kind of racial bigotry as a feature of our culture? At some point, do Mormons vote their forget their scriptures and vote their wallet, or what do you see as the source here?
What can be done about it?
Thank you, Fred, for that question. first of all, is racial bigotry a feature of the Mormon culture? Based on my own personal experience, yes. And I think a lot of it has to do with our culture as Mormons. It comes down to this. If we are Latter-day Saints, if we are God's chosen people, the children of Israel, then it naturally stems, or it seems to be logical, that culture which is developed within Zion must somehow be in harmony with God's plan. I mean, it just seems as a logical extension of this. I found in my own experience that those who have culturally assimilated into the white culture are accepted more readily by Mormons. And I think their race or their color is overlooked a little more readily. Those, on the other hand, that if I wanted to be an Indian activist and wear my hair very long and come to church without a tie and a white shirt and try and serve the sacrament, I think I would have problems. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's as much as I wanted to hazard right now. Now, the second part of your question was, would you repeat that for me again? I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just making a suggestion about how at some time we seem to forget the scriptures and yeah. Vote our wall, that is to say we vote economically rather than according to gospel principles.
I would have to agree with that.
But it's a side issue.
Yeah, okay. And I can say is that I agree with it. I think that is one tendency that maybe we need to work to overcome is the fact that we do tend to forget our scriptures at times when it comes down to fundamental issues of power or economics. It seems, at least in this situation, that the members of the church that were leading the resistance to Navajo enfranchisement were forgetting the scriptures and were fighting on a very basic level of power. It was more important to them to retain that power rather than to try and integrate the Navajos in with open arms and accept them for what they were. So anyway, yes, I think that is a feature that we have to wrestle with.
I've been writing about Utah Navajos for the last 6 or 7 years. So my territory is the other little corner of the reservation. And my experience in Blanding and Monticello and San Juan County is very much in harmony with what this paper suggests. That while it's true that not all Anglos are Mormon, the community leaders are, and the political leaders usually are, and some Navajos are Mormon. Nevertheless, the lines tend to be drawn between Mormons and Navajos just because of the makeup of the population. And while it's true that non-Indians are limited in terms of what they can do to enforce their laws on the reservation, it's also true that reservations support border towns. For example, all the money that is spent by people who live on reservations, or almost all of it, is spent in border towns. They have to go there to do their banking and get their groceries and buy their cars or whatever. And in San Juan County, the oil on the reservation not only underwrites the tribe, but helps to underwrite San Juan County. And the return in terms of services is far less, percentage-wise, than the money that flows off the reservation. So there are really two sides to that tension, plus the differences in the worldviews. So considering that we now have the first Navajo County Commissioner in San Juan County ever, and that there are a lot of tensions around that, I think that Utah's experience has been similar to Arizona's, although I'm not sure that it's been as embattled legally. I think that the voting registration has gone through more smoothly over the years. And so maybe that does suggest the Hispanic influence in New Mexico may have smoothed the way for some of this. In Utah, all minorities are very small groups, and until recently, Indians have been the second largest minority group, coming to about 2%. And, you know, that's pretty small.
Just from here, Ed, one of the things now, in St. John's, I don't believe many Indians actually shop in St. John's. Is that true? Very small
number. I think that's true.
They go mostly to Yelp, they would go to Holbrook, they would go. And so I don't think there's been an economic, and I think that was part of it. Whereas in New Mexico, at least I sense that part of that opening up, even though it was begrudging, was because, you know, the majority of the commerce in Yelp is Indian trade, not English trade. So that would be a difference.
Well, our time is up. I appreciate your attendance here, and we thank Mr. Pagan and Dr. Peterson for being here.